Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Plastics Recycling Update, where we bring you insightful conversations relating to the plastic recycling industries. Our guest today is John Richardson, who is a senior consultant at ICIS. He runs a very, very interesting blog called Asian Chemicals Connection. John, how about I leave it to you to introduce yourself to our audience?
I'm John Richardson. I'm based in Perth, Australia. I work for a company called ICIS. For the last 25 years, actually, as a consultant. And I look primarily at the virgin polyethylene and polypropylene markets, special focus on Asia Pacific and China, but I look at the global markets as well.
You recently wrote an article regarding China's long-term GDP growth risks and polymer demand. And in particular, you mentioned a massive challenge that China is going to have in the next few years was their shrinking working age population. Tell us a little bit more about this.
Well, if you go back to the 1960s, you look at the World Bank data, I think the birth rates per mother reached around six in 1962-63. And that demographic bulge delivered enormous benefits to China in terms of low labor costs. When those young people grew up and started joining the workforce from the 80s onwards, which is my generation, so it started work from the 80s onwards. And that led to a lot of migration from the countryside to the cities. A lot of the young people were in the countryside. They moved to the cities, these manufacturing centres, built with tremendous government support for infrastructure. And this is the history of it, explain where we've got to today. And so that was from the Deng Xiaoping reforms of the Southern Tour, the very important Southern Tour, Deng Xiaoping from the 90s, opening up the economy. And then it really was turbocharged by China joining the World Trade Organization in late 2001, giving admission to it. So the quotas and tariffs that restricted Chinese exports came off to the West. So suddenly you had a very youthful population. China could take maximum advantage of that youthful population and fantastic logistics and, you know, world-scale manufacturing to export everything to the West at very cheap prices, you know, blouses, shirts, washing machines, whatever, made in China, driven by the credit boom in the West. We got lots of cheap credit up to the global financial crisis. So this is the sweet spot for China when all those young people were of working age. Now, you've had the one-child policy, which, of course, has been abandoned now, which affects the birth rate. But also, in the big cities, people have got out of the habit of having children. So it's well below the 2.2 per mother replacement rate for the population for a long time, the birth rate. And we've never been in this place before. We've never had an economy the size of China, so important to the global economy, with these kind of demographic challenges. Now, with the case of Japan, yes, it's a major manufacturing economy, but it's not the workshop of the world. It wasn't the workshop of the world when it started to age in the same way that China's a workshop of the world. You know, and also the fact that those exports are so important to China's economy, it's 20% of GDP, right? And the problem is the working age population is now declining. It has been for a few years. So once you get out of the habit of having children, it's really hard to turn this around. And the data is quite shocking in terms of the growth of the 60 to 64-year-old cohort, the shrinking of the working age cohort over the next 20, 30, 40 years. Can be very hard to reverse. So it means, of course, in low-value manufacturing that wage costs are now going up. We've seen that drift of workers of low-value manufacturing to countries like Vietnam and India, Pakistan and Bangladesh in textiles. So what does China have to do? Right, how does it justify those higher wages? They have to escape their middle-income trap to become a higher-income country. Now, economic research shows that since the Second World War, 19 countries have successfully escaped their middle-income trap, but all but two of them had rising working-age populations. So this is the challenge. So what China has to do is become a South Korea. So South Korea had exactly the same problem, but their economy started to really develop. You think about Hyundai, LG, Samsung, you think about Hyundai Motors, LG, electronics, really clever high value manufacturing which requires access to higher value technology. That's what they've got to do to justify those wages. And the issue is, it gets very sensitive here, we've got to talk about it. Under the system of central control of the economy, will that encourage the kind of free thinking that leads to innovation that then leads to China escaping its middle income trap? Perhaps yes, perhaps no, that's the question. Will they be able to get access to the technology from overseas? Now we get into geopolitics, now it gets even more sensitive because the United States now regards China as an adversary since 2018. It's one thing the Republicans and Democrats agree on, that China's an adversary. We saw the recent measures restricting semiconductor exports to China. Can it get access to the technologies it needs to escape that middle income trap? We've never been in this situation before. It's a country the size of China with the scale of its demographic problems. And the issue is pension healthcare costs. Not just escaping that middle income trap, but can it raise tax revenue to pay for rising healthcare and pension costs, which again requires moving up that manufacturing value chain? We don't know. But we have to think of scenarios where what will China's economy grow like over the next 20, 30 years? A lot of the assumptions I've seen is it will grow up more than 2.5%, but there's a chance it could grow less than that or at 2.5%, which will be a dramatically lower growth rate that we've seen over the last 20 years in terms of GDP. Polymers are a multiple of GDP. So you would say that that would have a huge effect on chemicals and polymers demand if it cannot escape that middle income trap and its GDP in effect stagnates.
John, that's very interesting. So I guess the question I have for you is, time and again, policymakers in China have managed to navigate challenges in the past. What levers do you feel that they need to possibly pull or that they are already pulling to kind of escape this challenge?
This is a question of whether they're pulling the right levers. I mean, it is very sensitive, this. This is a problem that gets quite political. Do they need to get on better with the West? Or to put it another way, is the West taking advantage of China's vulnerability for geopolitical purposes? Yeah, that's the question. Is that relationship with the West? So the levers, you would say that relationship with the West is key to get access to that technology. And in semiconductors, China is a long way behind, the experts say. And you can't have a knowledge-based modern economy without higher value semiconductors. This is the problem. You could argue, I've heard very strong arguments that heavy government funding for innovation is the way to go. And as you say, they've had very great policy success in the past, right? Now, the example that I was given was five companies enter a new sector, electric batteries, for example. The government says to these five companies, well, not all of you are going to win. Only one of you will win, right? We'll write off the debts of the failing five companies. And if you work for the losers and you're any good, you get a job with the winner and the winner makes a fortune. So the lot of money they've thrown at innovation, the argument is that central control and strong government funding for innovation can lead to great leaps in higher value manufacturing. You've seen China doing really well in solar panels, electric vehicles, it's making progress in AI. But does that system really work versus the free market capitalist system? And can China, as I said, get access to critical gaps in its technology because of its relationship with the West? It's difficult because it has been very successful in the past, but one could argue that it's had a very favorable wind behind it because of very easy demographics. I mean, the challenges that China also faces is regional differences in demographics, because a lot of people have moved to the cities, as I said, the mass migration of the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. And the countryside is a lot older and a lot poorer, which is a problem. So you've got, you know, older demographic profiles across different regions as China, which is a challenge. And again, it comes down to these rising healthcare and pension costs. Now, I should also put this into context that it's not just the demographics, it's the debt as well. So you've got 20% of China's GDP is exports. You know, a lot of that has been traditionally low value manufacturing, although you can argue they can move some of that overseas under Chinese ownership, right? To Vietnam, Pakistan, made polyester fibers made in China go to textile mills in Pakistan, right? So that kind of works. But they've also got a problem with the debt. The 29% of GDP or thereabouts has been the real estate sector. And it's one of these problems we've known about for years, sort of kicking the can down the road, if you like. But since August 2021, the government said, right, these three lines in terms of the real estate debt, three restrictions on new lending for real estate companies. So now, right, we're going to deal with this issue of excessive borrowing in the real estate sector. Since the credit bubble really exploded in 2009 after the global financial crisis, we've reached a point now it takes $8 of debt to deliver $1 of GDP growth. So this was always going to happen, right? So you've got the problem now is all this debt, all this real estate. And we can see a pattern with chemicals demand from 2009 up to 2021, a huge acceleration in chemicals and polymers demand growth of China relative to the rest of the world. So China became the biggest polyethylene, polypropylene consumer globally, in volume terms, overtaking North America and Europe around 2008, 2009. As that credit bubble exploded, a lot of that consumption has been related to conspicuous wealth connected to real estate. Yeah, so people getting a lot richer, concentrated in 10 rich provinces where the real estate bubble has been located. So you take that dynamic of growth away from the economy because they've got these big debt, bad debt problems, and lots of empty buildings, you know, that they can't sell now. What is left to drive the economy, as well as they're facing the problem of an aging population? So you've got debt, demographics, geopolitical tensions all coming together to create what could be a very challenging outlook for China. I think you look at the polymer demand, and it's so important for the global industry because, take polypropylene's example, in 2000, it's 12% of global demand. By 2021, it was a high 30% of global polypropylene demand. China had become by far the biggest region in terms of consumption of polypropylene globally. And a lot of the assumptions are that, yes, growth will slow down. GDP growth will still be above 2.5% though. And that line carries on growing. And China maintains its importance as a driver of global polypropylene growth. And so that really sort of bankrolls the industry. But if that line is lower, because GDP growth is lower, we've got a real problem. Because you've lost a lot of the biggest growth dynamic of the chemicals and polymers market. If all these problems are not resolved, I'm not saying they won't be resolved, but you're facing as a debt, geopolitics, and demographics all coming together at the same time. This is the issue.
So the assumption is that supply is being planned according to a 2.5% GDP growth. And the suggestion is if it is below a 2.5% GDP growth for China every year, there's more supply than demand. Where do you see this in the short term, in terms of the supply-demand curve and therefore the pricing curve in the short term, say the next 12 months, the next 5 years, and the next 10 years? What does that look like, taking this into account, taking the looming recession into account?
Well, I know, Alkarim, we're getting away from just demographics because it gets kind of complicated. It's zero COVID. So the problem with zero COVID, there's been a lot of speculation in the financial press that the zero COVID will be relaxed soon. And you see the local stock market go up last week, down and up again. various rumors. I haven't seen the market today. But when you think about it, Chinese vaccines have limited effectiveness, right? It's claimed. It's claimed that if China were to relax zero COVID, the healthcare system is not very well funded, especially in rural areas. So it will be overwhelmed with the number of COVID cases, right? This is the problem. mRNA vaccines from overseas, it's difficult to import them politically, right? And anyway, if you did that, you have to revaccinate the population, which is an enormous task. China could develop its own mRNA vaccines, but they're not there yet. That's going to take time. So this zero COVID hurdle for the economy is a major factor behind oversupply at the moment. It's holding back consumer spending. I mean, because of the end of the real estate bubble, right? The amount of personal savings in China has gone through the roof, right? People are saving a lot more money, and it's always been high in China, right? The short-term thing for me on chemicals supply and demand is eventually when zero COVID is relaxed, whoosh, you'll get a huge boom in consumer spending and a boom in chemical pricing. What you've got at the moment, and we're getting we're getting away from demographics because that's a long-term thing, but you've got China pricing for polyethylene and polypropylene, which I look at, and it's same with the other chemicals and polymers. China's never been as cheap against the rest of the world in the history of ICIS pricing assessments, going back to the 1990s for some chemicals and polymers, right? Or you could say the rest of the world has never been as expensive. And the thing is that a lot of polyethylene and polypropylene has been basically trapped, oversupply has been trapped in China because of high container freight rates. So the companies have been unable to move that oversupply around the world as easily. You still see very high price premiums for polyethylene and polypropylene in India, Pakistan, Vietnam, Southeast Asia, Europe over China at the moment, but they have been coming down over the last few months. So where does that take us? I think absent the end of zero COVID and with the global inflation crisis and with the slowdown in global trade that will bring container rates down, making it easy to shift stuff around the world, there's a strong scenario where pricing around the rest of the world starts falling to Chinese levels. In other words, it starts falling back to the historic premiums over China. I mean, the rest of the world is normally more expensive, right? But you've got extraordinary numbers now in terms of how much more expensive the rest of the world is relative to China. And you can see those premiums coming down. So basically, the oversupply from China spreads across the world because it could trade flows enable that through the container rates coming down. And that would affect all the polymers. Especially polypropylene, that's the most oversupply because China's moving to a net export position in polypropylene. So that's the dynamic in the short term. In the background, you've got the demographics. In the background, you've got, that's the other problem, the common prosperity economic reforms designed to deal with that, right? And so that's a drip, drip, drip problem, if you like. It's going to take years to really play out. Can they deal with those demographics? Again, getting away from demographics, the immediate effect on the economy is the real estate bubble, the loss of momentum from building houses, right? Another problem that something like 70-odd% of healthcare and pensions funding is from the local provincial governments, right? They raise that money through land sales. They're not selling land. The price of land is not going up, it's going down. So you have a problem now is how are they going to pay for those rising pension healthcare as the population ages, when now the property bubble is over? You've got to create a whole new taxation system, which is not based on land sales. More and more land sales, therefore, more and more revenues to meet those social costs that are mainly met by the provincial governments. So you've got this link between, you know, real estate and demographics, if you see what I mean. That's the problem. So it's all coming to a head at a particular time. But I think the immediate outlook for me is, you know, the next 12 months is zero COVID. I think that's the critical thing.
That's very interesting. Now, John, since we're on the plastic recycling update podcast, how do we tie all of this in into recycled materials within China, outside of China? Where do you see all of this playing out in the long term, of course, in terms of the working age population, the need for high value manufacturing, the drive of environmental goals that the Chinese government has set? And how do you see all of this tying in terms of recycled materials in the short term and in the long term?
Well, I think if China were to escape its middle income trap, like say they do, of course, and we all want China to do that, it's good for the world, isn't it? They will develop a world scale, a world class recycling industry. They're already pushing in that direction. Got, you know, lots of legislation is being introduced in the cities to segregate plastic waste. A lot of government funding is going into it. They're cleaning up the rivers. The Operation Sword that banned the import of plastic waste made a big difference in terms of cleaning up the industry. So that would see a rapid development of the recycling industry, I think, in the scenario where they escape the middle income trap. I guess if they fail to innovate, you know, if the innovation push fails, right, could it fail in the recycling sector? Will they be able to get the technologies they need to be world-class recyclers? Will they be able to get the chemical, you know, recycling technologies? Will they be able to sort of develop the service industries that go with the recycling sector, the complex value, circular value chains that you know about, you know, the segregation of plastic waste, linking the waste providers with the chemical producers, with the plastic converters and the brand owners? That's quite a complicated process, isn't it? You build a whole new value chain. Will they be able to do that, you know, if they can't escape the middle income trap? Will that be one industry that fails in terms of the innovation needed to achieve that? So I think it's more of a long-term thing. I think short-term, the issue is just growth of demand, right? For all kinds of things, or, you know, manufactured goods, services, and how that relates back to chemicals demand as they struggle with zero COVID, as I said, and the end of the real estate bubble, I think.
And I think, how do you see zero COVID impacting the recycled industry in that sense, on the demand side, and then on the supply side as well, given the change in pricing of virgin polymers over the next 12 months, possibly?
That's an interesting point. I would have to look at some price comparisons of sort of recycled pricing in China, which I don't think we have an indices on at the moment at ICIS. We do European pricing. I mean, I could see the virgin pricing remaining, well, what's the price of oil going to be? Good luck with that, trying to estimate the price of oil. But barring oil shocks, which we can't predict, the pressure will be down on pricing, right? On virgin pricing. It'll certainly remain depressed until zero COVID ends. You know, you're looking at, you know, maybe the whole of next year, that downward pressure remaining on the virgin price. We'd have to compare that with the recycled price in China, whether that encourages more recycling. It's possible, yeah. Because, you know, you have the reverse, it encourages more virgin because the price is cheaper. Obviously, that's the problem the way around, yeah. That's the problem, right? So potentially it would actually be negative for recycling over the next 12 months. Yeah. Makes sense.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you about all things, especially the impacts of all of these challenges, the poly crisis, it seems, within the next 12 months, over a longer period of time, and trying to get a sense of how that might play out. Please let us know, where can we find you? I think, John, and I've personally enjoyed reading your articles for over a decade now, and they're always so insightful, always very much on point. And one exercise that I'm going to do is look at the articles 10 years ago, and I know that things have played out to a certain degree, that you are looking at them in that way. So please tell our guests, where can we find you? And would love to have them as well look into your content.
So, thank you, Ockrim. That's very kind of you. I mean, email me at john.richardson@icis.com anytime. And my blog is asianchemicalconnections.com, which you can find on the ICIS website, or just do Google it, Asian Chemical Connections, and I post once, two, twice a week, usually sometimes three times a week, depending if I'm traveling or not. Mainly on China, mainly on polyolefins. And I do look at sustainability as well. I've had a few posts on recycling the last 12 months and on carbon as well. And it's become part of the debate. If you disagree, that's fantastic, because we only really improve by sharing our views, don't we? Now, connect with me on LinkedIn as well. I'll post my articles on LinkedIn. It's all about creating that debate and sharing information.
Wonderful. Thanks, John. We'll hope to see you again soon.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.